don't we all start with the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Like I said, my name is John Kay, and I'm a compulsive eater. And hi, guys, and that's Susan H. She will be coming up in a minute, and welcome to the birthday party. We're going to be doing the sexuality workshop. That's just our shorthand for it. In fact, I told my sponsor, I'm leading the sexuality workshop, and he said, "Is it a hands-on workshop?" And I was, no. But the full name of this workshop is Loving Yourself, Loving Your Body, Loving Others, Finding Recovery and Self-Esteem, Body Image, Intimacy, and Relationships. So it's certainly a mouthful, but, you know, it actually makes up a group of topics that we don't talk a lot about at meetings, but there are a lot of them are the core of why a lot of us ate in the past, and for a lot of us, it's also why some people come in, have some success, and end up going back out in relapse. And I think a lot of these things are, make up the core, you know, the engine of emotion behind chronic relapsing. And, when we use the overarching term sexuality, it's really an umbrella word that brings up a pretty broad array of subtopics. Body image, you know, how we view our outside selves, our bodies, our appearance, our attractiveness to others. Self-esteem, which is sort of the inner version of body image, how we feel about our inner selves, our behavior, our personality. Then moving on to things having to do with this, like dating and putting yourself out there to meet someone or trying to. Love and vulnerability, you know, how to overcome the fear of intimacy and finding a way to trust another person. Relationships in general, I'm sort of following the way it should, I think it goes. Relationships in general, how to go from being by yourself to being with another person, sharing your life with them. And then intimacy and sexuality, taking all of those earlier topics and bringing them to the real world of an adult intimate relationship. We don't have all the answers here, but we believe the answers are available, you know, in the program and the steps and the big book, and we'll simply talk about our experiences and feelings about these things as they happen to us. One note, we will for shorthand say opposite sex. If you are gay, it's, you know, it's just like God. Everybody make it whatever you need to make it, you know. God knows there's 1,000 new categories now. And so the first part of this workshop, we'll be talking about body image and self-esteem, and then do some writing, and we'll do some sharing, and then we're going to take a break about 10:30, or 10:20, I think, give or take. And then after the break, we'll move on to intimacy, sexuality, relationships, and do some more writing and possibly some sharing. And we'll also have questions for the Ask It Basket. Oh, we have to get an Ask It Basket to send around. So anyway, to begin with, we will we'll start by introducing my co-leader, Susan H.
I have an Ask It Basket in my car. I'm Susan, and I'm a compulsive overeater. It's an honor and a privilege to be here, of course. I'll tell you my story briefly, you know, qualify briefly, and then get on to the subject. So my top weight is somewhere over 200 pounds. I stopped weighing before I hit 200 pounds because I couldn't do anything about what the scale was saying. It was depressing, so I just stopped weighing myself. I will be celebrating 30 years this in a couple days. Yeah. It's been quite a journey. I am a low bottom compulsive overeater. I started eating when I was 8 when my parents were divorced, and started getting fat when I was 10 and my father died. And I think it was just a perfect mix of I'm susceptible to sugar and flour, to the addiction of sugar and flour, and having some emotional pain. And so I learned that sugar and flour just took me out of my pain early on. And I started actually binging when I was 8 years old. So I, at my worst, gained 30 or 40 pounds in 2 or 3 months. And I couldn't keep my waitressing jobs, and I couldn't keep my alcoholic boyfriends, and I crashed my car, and I went to jail. And it's not because that was my character. I was a good girl. And it's just because that's where this addiction took me. I could not function in life. So I tried everything there was to try. I tried all the diets. I did all the diets. I did all the diets that you could pay for. I did all the diets in every magazine. I did all the non-diets. I did all the psychological things. I did metaphysics. You name it, except for surgery, I did it. And eventually I came to OA. I had a couple of boyfriends, both of which were addicts, and one ended up getting sober. And I thought, if he can do that, then so can I. And I knew that what I was doing with food was, I knew that it was an addiction. And in the 80s, what we knew to do for addiction was go to 12-step programs. I was very fortunate. So I came to these rooms, and I was willing to do whatever you told me to do because I wanted to stop doing what I was doing. Yes, I wanted to lose weight, but I really wanted to stop eating compulsively. I was not one of the people who wanted to keep eating and lose weight. I wanted to stop the insanity of what I was doing. And I lost a bunch of weight, got into size 12s and 14s, and part of me was absolutely thrilled. I was in normal sizes. I wasn't wearing big girl clothes anymore. And back then, this is in the 80s, we did not have cute big girl clothes. We wore muumuus. So at least those things have changed. And at the same time, I also really longed to be thinner. I really wanted to be in clothes that were not double digits. So I was not able to do that in program until I was willing to ask for perfectionism to be removed, which was 7 years into program. I started working the steps as soon as I got into program, and I was not willing to ask perfectionism to be removed because my experience is in the seventh step. You just get lots of experience dealing with those defects of character. And I did not want to deal with imperfection and with making mistakes, and so I was just never willing to give it up until it got too painful, and I finally asked for it to be removed. And then I was led to a way of eating that helped me lose the weight that I wanted to lose, surprisingly. Before that time, when I was size 12 and size 14, I worked a very rigorous program, and I did experience some judgment in these rooms. It was very painful. Part of this disease is that we're fat phobic, and that we are looksist. I come by it honestly. I come by it from my mother, who was a beauty queen and a sorority girl and a model and a broadcaster. And so probably where I have experienced the most judgment about my body is in these rooms. You know, outside, they don't care. They check me out or they don't check me out, but that's the extent of it. And so I, for many years, had to go to meetings where I felt safe, meetings where it wasn't necessarily thin as well. You know, I went to meetings where people thought I was well. I was working a good program. Size 12 and size 14 was good enough, and I was still working towards that healthy body weight. And eventually I got there. But it took some doing, and I had to come to acceptance about where I was at that size 12 and size 14. And a couple of things happened, and it was all around the same time that I was asking for perfectionism to be removed. Because things happen when you ask for things to be removed. And really where that happened for me was around my body, was giving up perfectionism around my body. So I was walking in Runyon Canyon in Los Angeles, for those of you who live here. And Runyon Canyon is a dog park, and there were lots of dogs around there. And I was looking at the dogs, and I noticed the greyhound, and I noticed the basset hound. And I was looking at that sleek, beautiful greyhound and thought, wow, that greyhound is just like Renee in my meetings, who's this sleek, beautiful woman. And then I saw the basset hound and thought, oh, the basset hound's kind of like me. And then I thought, there's nothing wrong with either one of those hounds. They're both hounds. They're both fine the way they are. neither one of them think they should be different. The Basset Hound doesn't think it should be a greyhound. And then I thought, if I were a dog, what kind of dog would I be? And I thought, probably a golden retriever, maybe. Lab, golden retriever. So some people told me I should be a poodle. I thought, no. No, maybe that's what I look like on the outside, but on the inside it feels more like a golden retriever. So, oddly, that helped me get into acceptance. And then I just sort of went on this journey of accepting my body where it was at. So for me, it became a study. And I found out a lot of things. And also at that time, there was this wonderful ad campaign, and I brought a picture of it. I'll pass it around. You may have seen it. It says there are 3 billion women who don't look like supermodels and 8 who do. could you pass that, John? Thanks. So I got to wondering, I don't try to be Einstein. I'm creative. I don't try to be Rembrandt. I'm a professor of theater. I don't even try to be Meryl Streep. Why do I try to be a supermodel? What is that in me that thinks that this body can be a supermodel? I also used to like wearing vintage clothes a lot. I still would, except you just can't really find them anymore. But at that time, I could wear vintage clothes. And I wore my grandmother's clothes and my great-grandmother's clothes and my great-aunt's clothes, great-great-aunt's clothes. So they were from, some of them were from the 1920s and the 1930s, and they fit me like a glove. I mean, just perfectly. And I realized this is my genes and heritage. This is what I've been given. I'm a Basset Hound. I'm not a Greyhound. And all these women who wore these beautiful opera clothes were Basset Hounds. And, you know, there are some things I can do, but I'm not willing to spend 2 hours a day in the gym and be hungry all the time so that I can fit some standard of beauty, which is not what I was born into. So then I started looking into standards of beauty and discovered that the very first Miss America was 5'4" and 135 pounds. I fit the standard of beauty in 1921. And, you know, the standard of beauty before that was even fuller. In fact, they wore bustles to make their behinds look bigger. And if you look at paintings before we had photographs, they were normal, average-looking women. And they were painting beauty. And they were, you know, they looked like most of the women that I see in this room today. So I'm also going to pass this around. This is these are pictures of Miss Americas through the years. And we got thinner and thinner and thinner. We still stayed sort of voluptuous certainly into the 40s and then into the 50s, although we were cinching our waists in the 50s. And then we started getting thinner, and we're still getting thinner. Thank you. And I also have, I have one other. Oh, on the other side of the, there are 8 billion women and only 3 billion women and only 8 are supermodels. There's a picture of Barbie. And if Barbie were a real woman, she wouldn't be able to stand up. They have actually done studies on this where she would fall forward. And her ankles would also not hold her up. So the other picture that's going around is if Barbie were real. Apparently Barbie's 19. When I played with her, she was 24, but Barbie's 19. And so there's a picture of Barbie, and then there's a picture of what Barbie at 19 would actually look like if she were a real healthy woman, a healthy thin woman. So the average woman, here are some statistics I found out. The average woman is 5'4". And Barbie is 6 feet tall. And a store mannequin is 6 feet tall. And the average woman weighs 145 pounds, more than me. Barbie weighs 101 pounds, at 6 feet. The average woman is 11 to 14, so that's where I was when I was getting judgment. And a Barbie is 4, and a mannequin is 6. The average woman's bust is 36 to 37, Barbie is 39, and a store mannequin is 34. Average woman's waist is 29 to 31, Barbie's is 19, and the store mannequin is 23. And the average woman's hips are 40 to 42, Barbie is 33, and a store mannequin is 34. I also heard a clothing designer, I can't remember who it was, but a famous clothing designer, say that he wants his models to be hangers. He wants it to be about the dresses. He doesn't want it to be about the models or about the bodies. So these supermodels that we think we should look like are hangers. So I just started to realize this is all a little crazy, that this is my goal and that this is what I'm spending all my time and energy trying to achieve and to accomplish. Catherine Deneuve, who was at one time considered one of the most beautiful women in the world, she's a French actress, she was quoted saying she could have a beautiful face or a beautiful ass. Her words, not mine. You can't have both. And I know exactly what she meant by that. When I have the hips I want, which are boy hips, because that's what society is telling us is in style now, then from here on up, I'm putting my hands on my waist, from here on up, I'm emaciated, and I have skin in my face. So when I'm a little fuller in my face, I'm a little prettier, and I'm a little fuller in my behind, right? So by default, I choose the face. Although I'm sure many of you have experienced, you have such a pretty face, which I got a lot of. And I know it's meant as a compliment, but I also knew what that meant. So I saw my body from my neck up. And then lastly, about this time, my mother was declining from emphysema. And she had been smoking all her life, of course, and she stopped smoking. She stopped smoking and gained some weight. And she was close to 80, and she was completely freaked out that she gained weight, and she would not buy any clothes. And I thought, this woman is 80 years old, and she's worried about the size of her ass. She really was. And she was declining, and she was on oxygen, and that's what she was worried about. And I thought, this is never going to end. This is just going to keep going. And this stops now. And for the most part, it did stop then. I did not want my life to be about my body, my weight, and my size. What a waste of my life. What a waste of my energy. I am not my clothing size. And when I get into where sometimes I am places where people think I am my clothing size and my worth is my size, I get out of there. Because it's kind of an Achilles heel for me, as my mother, that was true for my mother towards me. If people start thinking that my value is related to my size, I either get out of there or I do some serious self-parenting and remind myself that it is their problem, not my problem. It's their disease, not my disease. Now, I have this disease too, and I may have, I'm not in charge of the first thought, but I am in charge of the second thought. And I work very hard in these rooms to look at faces. So there's a wonderful quote from an author some of you may have read. She said, if all of the women, probably men too, who obsess about food and weight and body size stopped doing that and put that energy somewhere else, the world would change overnight. Think about the amount of energy that would then be available to move into something else. So once I got into acceptance about my body, then I was able to lose the weight I wanted to lose. body loathing, body hating, body shaming, beating up myself in any way never, ever has helped me work a program, and it's rocket fuel for the disease for me. So I think my time's up, and it's time for John now.
Thank you. Let's hear it again for Susan. Yay! I just want to mention, I have an Ask It basket there. I was able to get a hold of one. And if you could just sort of keep passing it around, if you hear something that either of us say that makes you say, gee, I wonder, you know, I have a question, please write it down. And also, if you could do me a favor, please print. Whenever we do these things, I go, I don't know what it says. So, yes. There's paper in the basket. There's paper in the basket, so we can do that. And my name is still John. I'm a compulsive eater. I'm trying to look. There's any of the people who are from Phoenix, I'm sorry, you're going to hear what you heard last week. I just want to say, first of all, I grew up as a fat kid. And I have been a fat kid. I've been a fat adult. And fat adult is better. Not great, but kids were brutal growing up. And it was really hard. And I became absolutely convinced that weight and attractiveness were linked, and that was the only part of it. I never looked at other guys and said, boy, he's smart, I wish I was as smart as him, or, you know, he's funny, I wish I was as funny as him, or caring, or any of these other things I think I would compare favorably to. I would always look at the thinnest guy and go, God, I want to be him, you know. Chris P. from down in Orange County has a great line. She says, the shortest distance to insanity is through comparison. You know, and I just love that line because, you know, one of the things I saw for years is I had such a negative feeling about myself. I would never spend any time comparing myself to the people I compare positively. I was always about, you know, making myself, reinforcing the idea I was less than. And I love to tell the story. I have been every iteration of this disease. I've been a compulsive eater. I have been bulimic. I have been exercise bulimic. And for one time in my life, one brief time, I was anorexic. And what happened is I came into this program. And if you've been heavy your whole life, the phrase goal weight is like you can almost hear angels singing. You know, goal weight. And I came in and I had a number, you know, and I was 26 and male and had the metabolism of a hummingbird. So I lose the weight very quick. And all my life I had no ability. I went through an alcoholic phase too, not a phase, but, you know, and part of it was it was the only time I could talk to women, so I had some alcohol in me. And so I came into the program and I still didn't like myself. I still couldn't talk to the opposite sex. I was incredibly shy. And in my head, when I hit that number, everything's going to change. And what happened is I hit that number and I hit that number. And I didn't like myself any better. I didn't feel any better. I didn't feel any more confident. So the wonderful genius brain of mine says, well, that must not be the right number. So I lost another 10 pounds and nothing changed. And I lost another 10 pounds. And I actually had people coming up in program going, are you okay? You know, and what it taught me, and I, you know, from this dense Irishman, I think it was the only way I could have gotten it, that there's no number on a scale that's going to make me like myself. Because if I'm putting a number on a scale, the contingent of when I'm going to like myself, and when I get to that number, it's going to be another number, and so on and so on. It's like being happy. If you say, I'll be happy when, as soon as you get that, you're going to move the goalposts. And that's certainly what happened to me. And it took me years in program to not be the fat guy up here. I lost the weight here a lot quicker than I lost it up there, and couldn't, you could look in the mirror. No matter what I would do, I would see myself as fat because I have some of the wreckage of my disease. I was 100 plus pounds more. So I'm sorry, there are physical results and damage as a result of that. And once I lost, again, part of this was I was clueless, okay? I didn't have sisters to explain signals, and guys are dense, okay? I know women think, oh, well, he'll catch the signal, and we don't, you know? Or a lot of us don't. And part of that is if you felt bad about yourself your whole life, it's hard for you to not think, well, I'm just being delusional when I see that, you know? I had a friend, I was in another Tulsa program for food for a while, and she had been like 300 pounds, and she lost the weight, and she was out with her girlfriends one night, you know, and she sees this guy across the bar staring at her, and she's like uncomfortable, and she's talking. Every time she looks over, the guy's staring. So finally, she just like walks around the bar and goes, what? And he's like, well, I thought you were pretty and I was thinking of asking you out. But I understand. If you spent your whole life, you can't, it's a part of you that can't grasp that. And I always say, and it's not pandering, even though, you know, most people here are women, that I think women have it harder than guys. Because, again, I lost the weight first 10 years in program, you know, except during a relapse situation. I have no idea whether I was attractive or not because I couldn't see. But women don't have that. You know, if you come in and you lose weight and you get attractive, you get attention whether you want it or not. And the trouble with that sometimes is it makes life infinitely more complex. It's something you want, but on the other hand, all of a sudden, oh, my God, there's a lot of more attention. And it becomes, you know, this party goes, well, you know, it was a lot easier to sit at home on a Saturday night and eat ice cream, you know. You know, and I'm not trying to say it, but it is a big part of relapse. I happen to have a particular affinity for that because, you know, I've been in for 34 years, but I only have 20 years of abstinence. And if you do the subtraction, you can see I went through a pretty major relapse. And so it happens to be a particular thing that I like to talk about a lot. And if anybody's having a real problem with relapse, see me, you know, sometime this weekend. The other thing is that, you know, the thing about attractiveness is you don't get to filter it. You don't get to say, yeah, I want to be attractive, but only to that person and that person and that person. And again, you know, it can be slightly scary, and especially if you've ever had any unwanted sexual advances in your, you know, your younger years. This can be pretty hard to deal with, you know. And the great thing is the answers are here. The answers are in the steps. They're in the big book. They're in with your fellow OA members. I always talk about it takes a village with us. There's people, you know, and I've had, you know, younger women come up and one of their problems is they've got a booby sponsor. I mean, she's wonderful, but she can't relate. And I go, well, you go talk to that person over there. She's young and she's attractive and she's doing great. Ask her how he or she was doing it, you know, like they say about sponsoring. And I could just so identify with all this stuff because I remember when I was, you know, first trying my, you know, to be out trying to meet people. I used to say I would go up to women like I was Oliver Twist, you know, with the bowl going, please, sir, I want some more. And I remember saying to a used car salesman one day, and this just shows you the self-loathing and how I felt about myself. I said, if I go up to try and ask a woman out, I feel like a used car salesman trying to sell a piece of shit car that he hopes will just get off the lot before it falls apart, you know? And, you know, I remember my therapist going, you know, that's pretty sad. You got to work on that. But it still comes down to the idea of faith, you know, the faith that, you know, our higher powers, whatever they are to you, are not going to bring you all this way to drop you on your butt. You know, that, that by working this program, you will find a way to see yourself differently, you know. For me, it was about working the steps, you know, the fourth and fifth. You know, when I finished my first fifth step, I walked out like walking on air, you know. And part of it, for the first time in about 20 years, I could look people in the eye. I just had such a feeling of being a piece of garbage that I couldn't look people in the eye, you know. And then in 6 and 7, you know, working on the character defects and then realizing I'm not terminally unique, you know. And be, you know, stop comparing my insides to everybody else's outsides, you know. And you know, and the other thing I did is, you know, my ego would aggrandize these things. I can't just be less than. I've got to be the worst person, you know. I love that line in program on the piece of shit the world revolves around, you know, at the top or at the bottom, you know. And I love one of my favorite quotes from the big book is from the On Acceptance chapter, Dr. Paul O. from down in Orange County. And it's actually the paragraph after the one that we all know, the acceptance paragraph. And it says, when I criticize you or me, I'm criticizing God's handiwork. I'm saying I know better than God. And for years, I would quote that to my sponsees, but it was about my judgmentalism toward you. But that's not what it says. It says, when I'm criticizing you or me, I'm criticizing God's handiwork. And I got to realize I'm right where I am supposed to be in my higher power's judgment today. And it's hard because, you know, I want to be, you know, perfect right away. That's my personality. And in the 8th and 9th steps, you know, to know that I've done my best to clean my side of the street up. And the thing that happens is it changes the concept of self-esteem for me, you know. I love the line, you know, getting self-esteem involves doing esteemable acts, you know, to be willing to, you know, it'll make me feel better about myself. And it does. And at the bottom of all this, I believe, if for me, all the things I have going on in my life is fear of one kind or another. Now, guys, we love anger because anger is the macho emotion. You know, I always joke newly sober or abstinent guys have two emotions, angry and about to get angry, you know. But anger is still a secondary emotion. If you scrape away, it's either fear or hurt. And that's something guys sometimes have trouble talking about. And, you know, and I'm just, I always felt, the other thing about the comparison, I never felt like a textbook male, you know, not a big football guy. I like musicals and that, you know, all gets, oh, are you gay? No, I happen to be a straight man who doesn't like football and likes musicals. I mean, you know, I never understood the correlation, but you know, but you know, again, I can't compare favorably to fellow guys. And when I gotta be honest, when I'm in a totally guy environment, I don't feel comfortable. And, you know, I needed to see myself in a whole picture. It was really hard. It's, you know, it's about how you feel. And the one thing I think I've come to over the years is that the real attractiveness in people is how you feel about yourself. How comfortable are you in your own skin, you know? I had a friend from that other food program who came in at like 500 pounds, and he got down to about 300, but he never got much below 300. But the guy was, to use a guy phrase, a chick magnet, because he was 300 pounds, but he grew up in a different kind of family than I did. His parents loved him and told him he was great, and he liked himself, and he was funny, and he had all these other characteristics that and as a result, he was different. And I would be at that goal week going, how does he do that? Because I still couldn't because I had the fat head, you know. And the longer I'm around, the more it starts to dawn on me how the weight, at least in terms of me, I need to separate those and realize it's not really about it. Yeah, I want to be at a healthy body weight because I'm sane when I do that, you know. But it doesn't have to be about the weight anymore. I love to tell this story. I was part of a really good, strong group in Connecticut when I lived there. And there was this woman I had a crush on. Okay, she looked like Christine Lottie. I don't know how many people know her. She's great. But she's even better looking than her. And I would just, every time I saw her. Now, she was married, and she married to a doctor. But I just had such a crush on her. And then she spoke one night, and she talked about how she felt she looked ugly. She still felt fat. She felt ugly. And I remember I'm driving home thinking, God, isn't that just like us? Here's this woman I just think is the most gorgeous woman in the world, and she thinks she's fat. And I started thinking to myself, well, what is it that I find attractive about her? And I got thinking, well, she's got a great smile. She's got a great laugh. She's funny. She's intelligent. Yeah, she's attractive. But I got thinking, almost all of those qualities are things when she gets up in the morning and stands in front of the mirror like I do and go, huh, she's not going to see those. She doesn't see how funny she is. She doesn't see her laugh. She doesn't see all these other levels of attractiveness. She looks in looks in the mirror and looks at myself, and that's what I got. And it taught me that, you know, if I can see that in her, maybe I can see that in me and realize, you know, there's more to that. And to me, you know, it was an important thing. It's about the lack, you know, about self-esteem. And, you know, part of my problem with self-esteem is that, I had such cynicism about changing that. You know, I joke, I have the trifecta of cynicism, okay? I'm an alcoholic comedian from New York. You know, you put those things together and then you give me like one of these slightly sickly sweet things the program talks about and I roll my eyes and go, oh God, kill me now. You know? But the number one that I used to roll my, and you know, here's the truth about cynicism. It's another arrow in my disease's quiver. Because if I can get cynical about it, I don't have to give it any real consideration. And chances are, if I'm cynical about it, it's hitting something in here I don't want to look at, you know. And I would hear the concept of positive affirmations, and that would just, I swear, you know, like, what am I going to stand in front of the mirror and go, you're a good person, gosh darn it, and people like you, you know. And I would just, I don't know what people, but you know what? I bought hook, line, and sinker all of the negative affirmations I told myself every day. You know? No, you're a piece of garbage. You're, you know. And the weird thing, things I got from my youth. I'll tell you a quick story. The last time, my mother passed away a few years ago, but one of the last times I was there, she's doing something in the kitchen, and she's got a dish in her hand, and she turns around, and she catches her elbow on the refrigerator and drops the dish, and it breaks into 1,000 pieces, and she looks and goes, you stupid idiot. And I go, that's where I got that one. You know, and so many of these other things, to hold myself to this ungodly standard, and I know somewhere I grew up, because I grew up as a little bit of a latchkey kid, And I sort of raised myself from about 13 on. And you know, we don't let 13-year-olds raise other kids because they're not mature. And what I got somewhere along the way was there was two states. There was perfection and there was shit. And if I wasn't perfect, I was shit, or a version of that. And I had to realize, like Dr. Paul says, you know, I am exactly where my higher power is supposed to be. And the other thing I did a long time was wait for that. When am I going to be perfect? You know, as soon as, and that thing with the gold weight. Well, wait. And what I realized when I really scraped away, that was fear. And I didn't want to really be getting out there. Even though I said I was, there was a part of me that used that as an excuse. And the reality is, like Susan said, there's a huge amount of different people at different weights and different levels of, you know, and let, you know, realize the other thing about attractiveness is it's a purely subjective thing, you know? People, I look at people that, that the society says are the most gorgeous women and I go, I don't get it. And then, I mean, like, I find Whoopi Goldberg cute and people say, oh my God, she's, it's all about, you know, whatever, you know, I joke every day. I joke with my wife and we talk about who's smarter and I go, well, I would never marry me. So I think I have to be smart. But, you know, and she thinks I'm very attractive and I'm a straight guy. So I guess I don't know what a attractive man is supposed to be. But the whole idea, and I'm going to end on this and we're going to talk about a writing thing is, I had a friend in the other program who I thought she was so cute and, you know, all this. And she'd get up at every meeting and go, boy, you know, I got to get to that. You know, as soon as I lose these last 5 pounds, I'm going to start doing this. And I finally walked up to her after a meeting. I said, Gabby, I got to tell you, you're the only one on this planet who doesn't know you're not at goal weight. What are you waiting for? You know, and that was a big part of it, of realizing, you know, to make this about that weight and make it about, again, God, what Susan says is so true. The crazy standards we put ourselves up to people who are, first of all, you know, in the top 1%, but then get photoshopped and then go get the best people more making them up. And we're sitting there looking at these people going, well, how come I don't look like that? Well, for one thing, you didn't have a makeup person and this and that doing all those things. And again, you know, like you were saying, Susan, I've said for a long time, I don't know when the paradigm of female beauty became a teenage boy, but it did somewhere in my lifetime. I don't get it as a guy. So, like I said, the other thing is about, you know, waiting until you're perfect and how, you know, why. You know, life is short. Don't do that. So, Susan, you want to explain the writing exercise? He's like, thank you. That's my job. Are we? Or are we doing? Okay. So, here.
So, we're going to give you about 10 minutes to address a couple of questions. And there are two questions. What are you putting on hold until you're perfect or goal weight? That's what most of us think perfect is. So the first part, you'll spend your time writing about what you're putting on hold, what are you waiting for? And the second part is what actions can you take now towards living the life you want to live? For example, I love to swim, so I always went to the beach. One time, somebody barked at me, and another time, somebody called me a great white whale. It didn't matter to me. I was swimming and doing what I loved, and I knew it was their problem, not my problem. I did not. So that's an example. I did not put swimming on hold. I did not put going to the beach on hold. And, you know, I have a big, long list of things that I did put on hold. So you have about 10 minutes to write on both those questions. What are you putting on hold? And what actions can you take now towards living the life you are waiting to live? Looks like people are looking for paper and pens, so if you could share some with people around you, that would be wonderful. Yeah, I'll repeat them both. What are you putting on hold until you're perfect or reach goal weight? And what actions can you take now towards living the life you are waiting to live? I'll give you about 10 minutes to do this writing. I think I'm hearing no. All right. So we'll have a little bit of time to share a little later. Right now we are going to address the Ask It Basket questions, and you can continue writing if you need to while we address the questions. John, why don't you take yours?
One of the questions I have concerns the fourth step. How long did it take you? How many times did you do it? The first one was a little longer than the rest. I tell my sponsees now, it says, you know, make a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself. It doesn't say write a Russian novel. part of it, I say, is if you're planning on being around, you're probably going to do another one or two of these at least. And I know that was certainly the case with me. I've done numerous ones. I had one person who was a sponsor who made me do it longhand, and which was excruciating for me because I'm just so used to typing. But I plan on doing more. There's two different theories in program about working through the steps and then staying in 10, 11, 12. But I happen to believe you deal with that peeling the onion kind of thing, where things that I didn't even think of in my first one or two four steps came up and keep coming up. And like I say, it's about peeling the onion. I just get annoyed. They seem to keep making more onion on me. So for me, and it, you know, like I said, just I kept working on it. And I plan on, you know, every few years or so looking, saying, am I ready? And the other thing is, as I did them, I didn't regurgitate everything in the past. I tried to look at stuff that happened in between, you know, between my last one and then. And so they do tend to get a lot smaller. How do you handle people? Oh, sure. I'm so sorry, Susan. It's all about me, don't you know?
And part of my recovery is having a voice. So I was very willing to do whatever you told me to do when I got in here. And so when I first went back home to Seattle and I was abstaining, and I couldn't believe how much pain I was in. Because I was not anesthetized anymore with my drug. And my sponsor told me to do a four step. So I did the four step that was in the big book, and I did it specifically on my family. And that's what I've always done. Whatever is bugging me, I did inventories on my sexuality. I did inventories on my career. I did inventories on my friends. I did inventory on my mom. I did inventory on my dad. But I also did... I've been here a long time, and I've been very willing. I did all kinds of different inventories, and I did the how inventory, which is the Russian novel inventory. And that actually didn't help me figure out what my character defects were, which is the end result that you want out of the inventory, or your behavior patterns or coping mechanisms, whatever you want to call them. And then there was one called the prenatal inventory, and that's what you're feeling when you're in the womb. Sounds really stupid, but mine started out with, it's crowded in here, there's not enough room for me because I'm a twin. And yeah, I was like, well, that's the story of my life. That's quite a character defect there. So I should probably look at the question. How long did it take you? So really, an inventory can take me 2 hours. It does not need to be a 2-year process. And I love the inventory that's in the big book because they're just bulleted statements. Boom, boom, boom. I'm mad at you and you and you and you and you and you and you for this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And then that other column, what's my part in it? That's the hard part. But pretty easy to do. Don't let it stop you.
Right. Yes, quick. The Nike fourth step, just do it. And I was taught when you start with the resentments, just start naming people, you know, and then don't worry about going across right away, because just think of as many people. And when you can't think of anybody else, start going across. And then even then, you're going to remember more people and keep going. And yeah, the quicker you do it. Look at the big book. These guys were doing that right away. How do you handle people making a big fuss about how much better you look after losing weight? Well, it's a really interesting thing, because I always find it was a one-sided thing in a way. I went through a massive relapse, and I was going to 3 to 5 meetings a week, and I was gaining weight like crazy right in front of everybody, and nobody ever said a word to me. And I look back, and I was like, why? Why didn't somebody at least come up and say, you know, say something to me? Because, you know, I always say it's not about the weight in program any more than it's about your breath in AA. But if you come in and you're talking about being abstinent and you have booze on your breath, I'm going to, you know. And the people I know in my AA meetings will, if they know somebody's having a problem, will at least go up and say, hey, is there anything I can do? They're not going to be judgmental, but hey, anything you want to talk about. But then when I lose weight, oh, yeah, look at this. You lost weight. How wonderful, you know. And I'm like, well, why didn't you mention that, you know, when I was going up? And I understand. We feel so about weight, the idea of approaching anybody, doing the 12-step within stuff I think we're supposed to do is really hard for us because it was such a matter of shame and stuff earlier, and it doesn't have to be. Do you anything? No. Okay. Even though I work on and mostly am in acceptance of my higher weight, I gained 7 pounds after 10 years of maintaining. I still think I was happier and had better self-esteem and confidence when I was thinner. Have you experienced weight gain, and are you able to feel great about yourself in spite of your higher weight? Well, let me tell you. I did. I gained about 15 pounds in more than a couple of years, and part of it is I got older. I got older, and I got less food. And there's a wonderful person who used to be my sponsor in program, and I won't say any more than that right now. But who always says, I used to be able to eat this much food, and now I get to eat this much food, and I mourn that difference every day. I hope I'm quoting him. I'll ask him later. And I know I finally had to be an adult and say to myself, John, take a look in the mirror. You know, if you want to be doing the 12-step work, you have to be an example. And to go up and mention to people who may have, you know, who may ask me about it, being in OA and being overweight, they're automatically going to think, well, geez, does this thing work? And so, you know, over the last year or so, slowly, what I did is I essentially did more exercise. I tended to be an exercise phobe, which was really married up to my youth when gym for fat kids is miserable, you know. And to realize, no, I'm doing this today for me. And that exercise made up the difference between where my metabolism was at 40 and where it is now. And so, but yeah, people would come up and so for me, and I didn't feel, I wish I could say, I have a cousin who I grew up with who's rail thin, and then I met him when I was out doing comedy on the road, and he was turned into this big old, and he's a deputy sheriff down in Florida, hee-haw, and he's big. And he and his wife are happy, and they don't care because they didn't have the psychological trauma I had grown up. It's really hard for me to be really overweight of any kind and not have part of that. I know it shouldn't be. I should have grown past that, but that's what happened to me. You know what I mean? Okay, so Susan's going to talk about that later. You want to take some of the other ones there?
Thank you. I should have organized these. Susan, did you lose your weight on gray sheet? And what is your plan of eating at this time if you care to share? I love this question. I have lost weight on gray sheet. I personally cannot sustain protein and produce only. I wish I could. More power to you if you can, but I have not been able to do that. So what happened was there's a prayer in the OA 12 and 12 in the third step on page 23.
It'd drive you crazy if you're not right.
No, I know it's page 23, but instead of trying to remember it, I might as well just read it, right? And glasses. As we become aware of what our eating guidelines should be, we ask God for the willingness and the ability to live within them each day. We ask and we receive first the willingness and then the ability. We can count on this without fail. So that's quite a promise, and I realized, you know, I don't even know what my eating guidelines should be. So I just began the daily prayer, please show me what my eating guidelines should be. And I got led to an outside place, one that I had never heard of. I thought I'd tried them all, but I hadn't been to that one. And it really worked for me. And it's not just protein and produce. And it taught me a lot about eating. I thought I knew everything there was to know about eating. I thought I was a nutritionist. I think we all are. And then I realized I did not understand my sensitivity to carbs and where I am on the susceptibility scale with sugar and flour. And I started to see that if I eat some rice, I feel like I'm going to die if I don't get a cookie. And there's no such thing as one cookie for me. So I've never binged on rice. I can't imagine I ever will binge on rice. If I eat corn, I start noticing bakeries. So I'm very susceptible to carbs. And I guess my message in that is I prayed and meditated and got led to where I need to go. I'm happy to tell you where it is afterwards, but I don't think that's important. I think we all need to find the one that works for us. Susan, I've tried to control my weight and pant size all my life, and the smaller I got, the bigger and more sick I was. How do I work on allowing my body to go where it should and not remain a size I can't be when following a meal plan? I need to give that some thought. I just read that and thought, whoa, I'm sorry. The self-loathing process about your body image, how long did it take you to stabilize those emotions? Susan, you have 30 years in program. I would like to know if those emotions were present 5 or 10 years after you entered the program. I lost weight pretty quickly when I came into the program because I was overeating so much. I was overeating at what I call the lethal level, and I stopped overeating at the lethal level. And so I was happy to have lost weight and to be in normal sizes. I really hesitate to say this, but I'm going to. Where I experienced body loathing was in these rooms. And I went to meetings. I still go to meetings, and my home meeting peeps are here where it's safe for me to tell my truth and where I am not my clothing size. It's tough in Los Angeles. We're the, you know, we're the image of the world. It's been a long, long time since I've had body loathing. So I did lose that. You know, I do have a higher power. Sometimes I call it God, God for shorthand, and all of that stuff really does get taken care of. Let's see what else is coming up. Oh, people frequently gain weight after skin reduction surgery to correct from obesity. Do you have any insights or recommendations about this surgery and how to not gain weight? Why people gain weight? Oh, well, they gain weight because they're compulsive overeaters. if only there were a magic pill. So I do have skin, you know, I have all that crepiness. Some of it is from being older, but some of it is from losing weight. And I actually did look into getting it taken care of, and then some of you may have done it, but they told me that they would do a seam down my arms and a seam down my legs and, you know, tuck it in just like a clothing seam. And I said to him, why is that better than crepey skin? And he said, well, you would look better in clothes. And I thought, I just personally decided, I'm okay. I'm not thrilled with it. But so all of the acceptance that I did on being overweight, I don't even like to call it overweight, on being average, all of the acceptance that I did on being an average-sized woman, I'm now doing on being an age-appropriate woman, you know, and... And they're battle scars, you know. I won the battle. And I would rather have my crepey, saggy skin than being unhealthy and not being present and not having clarity. How do you turn off the negative head? So I remember that fat is not a feeling. Feeling fat was my best friend. Feeling fat was a distraction from my life. I had one feeling, and it was feeling fat. I didn't know my whole emotional life because I put it all into feeling fat. So when the negative head is going off about my body, I ask myself, what's really going on? What is? And there's always something else going on. Because it's easier. It's easier to feel fat than to actually deal with life. I'm seeing if there's anything else. What do you mean when you say the weight just came off? I don't know if that was me or John that said that. If I said something like that, what I mean is I was not able to take off the weight. I mean, I tried everything there was to try. I was not able to take it off until I asked for perfectionism to be removed. And I wouldn't say the weight just came off, but that's when I started saying that prayer, and that's when I got led to the place that helped me lose my weight. Okay, so now we are right on time, and it's time for you guys to share anything you would like to share on what's been talked about or what you wrote about. And you will be timed. Do you have a timer, John? Can you use your phone? All right.
And please keep sending the Ask Your Basket around, and we'll get to more later.
Yes, and if we missed any of these, we'll get to more of those, too. Would anyone like to come up and share? So my wonderful husband, who's in this room, says, who would like to start recovering? We'll give you 3 minute shares.
Thank you. Well, that did it for me. I definitely am interested in recovering because for me, recovering is about living, and I want to live fully. My name's John, and I'm from Nashville, Tennessee. I used to be from L.A. I got sober in L.A. in 1980 and came into OA in 81. It has been a difficult, much more difficult path for me than AA. On the questions, what have I put off until I reach goal weight? There are very few things that I'm actually putting off. I'm getting to a point in my life where I realize I better do this stuff that is left for me to do, or it won't happen for me. So I generally, if I want to do something, I generally do it. But there have been some things like I've been putting off doing a knee surgery probably longer than I needed to because I thought that losing some more weight might bypass the need for that surgery. I probably don't buy as many clothes as I would buy. I have a fantasy that when I'm at goal weight, I'll buy a whole bunch of clothes and, you know, you may have that too. And I probably hang on to things longer than I would, you know, in this reaching goal weight. But for me, honestly, goal weight is more about health at this point in my life than it is anything else. I have health issues that are very serious. So I think more about getting healthy and living longer and being mobile more than, you know, fighting the perfect girl or something. I'm already married to her.
No. So,
she's incredible. She really is, and there are some things like I do ballroom dancing, and I think I'll dance better if I get to goal weight, you know. And I guess one of the things I need to accept is here's, you know, I'm at this place, and you know I'll dance as well as I dance, and I'll enjoy that. I have felt that I might have less problems with depression, which has been a problem I've had my whole life, and anxiety. But honestly, you know, and I could probably confront that more directly than I do. But I do see a therapist, and I do work in that area. Anyway, there are, it's not the way it used to be. I used to think that my life would be perfect when I lost weight. Well, I've learned that that's nonsense. And got a lot of wonderful things in my life, and really I'm more oriented toward health at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, guys can also just line up here if you want. And you won the race.
Hi, I'm Jessica, compulsive overeater. Thank you both very much for your share. Can you hear me? Okay. A question about, I really like the question that somebody asked about, explain how the weight just came off. And that was my story. I came in here at 185 pounds. I'm 5'2". Well, I was 5'2 then. I'm a little shorter now. I'm shrinking. And I really had no hope. I really never thought I would lose this weight. In fact, I told myself that on a daily basis. That was one of my mantras, was that you'll never lose this weight, that you were, this is how you're going to look for the rest of your life. And even in program, I would say that to myself. And one day, someone told me to do this, and I actually did it. I stood in front of the mirror with no clothes on, very scary prospect, at 185 pounds, and I said, I love you just the way you are, no matter what you weigh. And I started losing weight. For some reason, and that really makes me cry, I was able to stop doing some destructive food behaviors that I had been doing, you know, for a long time. And that really helped me, because when I stopped doing that, I had high cholesterol. I stopped eating the things that cause cholesterol to grow in your body. I didn't exercise. I just quit doing destructive things with food, like buying a bunch of food and then not eating it because I had to eat some cake, and then throwing away the lettuce because I had to eat, you know, goodies, and buying every kind of chocolate that there is in the store and putting it in my basket, and then systematically going through it and buying all these different foods that I would eat instead of the stuff I was supposed to be eating, even though I had it in my refrigerator and I wasn't eating it. But I stopped doing that. And then one day I started looking at how much I ate. And so I started looking at my portions. And portion size was always on my what I'm going to do when I get better list. You know, as one of these days I'm going to change this portion size. I'm going to work on portion size. And suddenly I was just doing it. It was the hand of God. I would put it on my plate with my left hand and take it off with the right hand. And that right hand was not me. This was me. And that was not, I'm left-handed. It went on with the left hand. And God took it off my plate. I would look at it and think, no, that's too much. And I'm like, that wasn't me thinking. That was somebody else. That wasn't me. That was a power greater than me putting that thought in my head. And then I actually had the willingness to do it. So probably in the first 9 months of being in OA, I lost 50 pounds in the first 9 months. And then subsequently I lost more weight through other situations that I had no control over. But thanks for letting me share.
Hi, my name's Alma, and I'm a compulsive overeater. I've been in program since 2011, and I just, before I do my share, I wanted to, give a little background. I came in for program pretty broken up, and like, Susan, this is basically my last stop. So it's been a journey for me, and, I go back to the perfectionism, and I know that my higher power and God is there, and things will fall in place when they fall in place. But I think that for me, the question about what actions can I take now to live the life that I want to live, and this is something that I've struggled with since I've been in program. It's gotten better. Boy, has it gotten better. But basically what I wrote about, because I want to speak my truth, and I feel like if I face it, say it here, I will walk out of these rooms saying, okay, that's a goal. that's an action plan. So for me, stop getting so fired up about the things that others do to me at work to undermine me, and they piss me off. Basically, that sends me home all worked up. Then I start getting food obsessions, thoughts. I don't know how to sometimes de-escalate myself from that fight or flight situation when I'm at work. Program taught me how to do it. But when I'm in that mode, it's tough for me. And that's something that I really feel that I need to work on to be able to live the life that I need to, that I would like to work, live. I know that, you know, before served as a defense mechanism, but I was not happy back then. I guess for me, what can I do now is, I meditate, and I think that I need to write about it. Because it is, if it's bugging me, and I know I'm no angel, what was my part in all this? And that's the part that, and I'm sorry, that's a defense mechanism. And that's the part I've gone better. I've made a lot of progress. I know that I have the control. I had that defense mechanism that, you know, I'm going to attack back. I've learned to just let it go, and I've learned to, not all the time, but I do say my serenity prayer when I'm at work and when I'm feeling really about to be set off. And also just, you know, it has been just a journey and a process for me. It's been about just asking God, please, I do the serenity prayer. I feel so much better after that. My meditation, I had an incident yesterday. I was so fired up, but I knew I was going to come to the OA conference, and I was just, like, so elated about that. So my meditation did it. But I think for me, if I really want to make another leap forward, it's going to have to be do more writing. If it's bugging me, start writing about it and do an action plan. Thank you for letting me share.
Hi, my name is Jody, and I'm a grateful recovered bulimic. And I want to thank you, Susan and John, for your shares. Thank you so much. I have a lot of thoughts going on in my head. Not sure if I can make this coherent, but I'll try. OA members come in all sizes. I love that pamphlet. I'm one of those who started dieting at 17 and lost the weight pretty readily. And it was only after I lost the weight that was a little bit too much that I started binging and then restricting because I was binging. And the binge restrict cycle began. I do know that I have an allergy to refined carbohydrates, caffeine, which was my speed that allowed me to lose weight. And I have an obsession of the mind, like any compulsive overeater. I can put down those things for a time, but I will pick them up again if I don't work the steps, if I don't try to become fit spiritually. So though I may look different from the average compulsive overeater, I am a compulsive overeater. In some of the meetings I attend, I hear this talk from the Big Book about what is a real compulsive overeater. And, you know, it doesn't mean you've gained a certain amount of pounds or you've lost a certain amount of weight. It's just, I have this obsession of the mind. And the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. It's the only requirement. So I'm very grateful to be a longtime member of this program. Grateful to be here with all of you. I also wanted to address what Susan said about the place where I've felt the most judgment is in the rooms of OA. And I can relate to that. And I have to ask myself, what is my part in that? What have I done to make other people feel insecure around me? I don't know, you know. But I do know that OA members come in all sizes, and together we can make it. And I feel a kinship with anyone in OA and everyone in OA. And I hope that others feel that way with me too. And other anorexics and other bulimics. And this disease runs the gamut. So that's all. Thanks.
Hi, my name's Linda. I'm a compulsive overeater. I want to thank everyone who shared. I was putting life on hold, and you know, and through the program, I had gotten rid of some weight, and I'm still wearing the same sizes. And my sponsor and my fellows told me, you know, I need to wear appropriately sized clothes. And I thought I was. I didn't even realize that they were hanging on me. But so I you know, went shopping with a friend, and I got when I say shopping, I went into my closet because I have all the sizes down to my goal weight when I was in high school. So, you know, I have all the clothes, so I really don't have to go shopping. It's all out of style, but who cares? Anyhow, so a friend came over and helped me find something that looked right. And also, the other part was I had to get rid of what wasn't the appropriate size for me anymore. And I was looking at it, and I had price tags on some, and some I wore like once, because I was saving everything for, you know, a special occasion. And I realized, you know, I just didn't feel good enough. You know, I wasn't special enough to wear those good clothes. And I didn't deserve it. And I really deserved to wear my baggy gray sweats that, you know, hung down to my knees. And, you know, because who cared? Because I didn't like myself and I didn't want people to look at me anyway. And I realized now through this wonderful program that we have, I realized I can wear nice clothes. And every day is a special day because I am now on this side of the earth and not buried. And I'm grateful. And I feel like I have my life back. And I just, you know, I'm happy with the way I am now. And I'm still on a journey, but every day is a gift, is a present. So, you know, and so I'm going to pass.
I said no more after. Oh, no, we really meant it. Yeah.
Sorry about that. Hi, my name is Kathy. I'm a compulsive overeater from Northridge. Hi, thank you. Thank you very much. There was a mention of body self-loathing. One of the things I struggle with is body narcissism, that when I am thin enough and cute enough and sexy enough and wearing the right clothes, which, yes, they are all in my closet, then I'm fine. And so when people come up to me, when I have in times in the past been at goal weight, or way under goal weight, it makes me really angry. Because what they're saying to me is, well, Kathy, you're not really good enough. And when you're overweight, you weren't good enough. But finally, you're in the right clothes and at the right weight. And now you're good enough. Isn't that great? And I just want to punch them in the mouth. So I have to get over that. I have to deal with that. That's my issue. That's not their issue. And yet it is still, I've been programmed this time about 3 years, it's still underneath it. And I think that one of the reasons that I have not lost a lot of weight in program is because that's what's hiding in the closet. And that's the character defect that it might be some type of fear of losing the weight, that I don't want to be that person on display. I grew up with a mom, very narcissistic, and she wanted me to be the person she couldn't be and the weight that she couldn't be and wear the clothes she couldn't wear. So I am just putting it out here and confessing it and asking God to remove it and replace it with a true self-worth and a true self-image and body image. So thank you.
We're going to take about a 10-minute break and then come back for more about intimacy, love, and relationships.